A warm welcome to all of you. A warm welcome to those of you who are watching on the webcam and to those who will be watching on the website later. If you're a visitor and have travelled far, you are particularly welcome. My name is Paul Murray, and I'm at this lecture in part of our long tradition, which is that we have open pulpits and in which members of the congregation will lead the service. And at the moment, Bridget, our minister, has retired, and we are waiting for the oncoming of Gavin Byrne. So there are more open pulpits available. Around the world, Unitarians light a chalice as a beacon of hope, as a sign of our search for truth and meaning, and most important, to highlight our communion with each other. In this uncertain world, where wars and lies and disinformation are increasingly common, where the rule of law is being undermined by governments, our chalice light is, we hope, a flicker to show that we try to do more than curse the darkness. Let us spend this time together reflecting on how we as a community go about our secular and spiritual lives, how we react with each other and those outside. We might meditate too on what the strengths and failings are within this congregation. What is it that makes us a community, a distinct community? And are we merely attending a different venue rather than a distinctive spiritual space? Who consciously or unconsciously do we exclude? And if so, why? We now have our first hymn. It's number 129. Let love continue long. Our reader is Trish.
Good morning, everyone. I have a very short reading, but the 50 or so words in it really packed a punch for me, and it's been on my mind for a while, so I decided it would be my reading today. It's by a young woman called M. Barry, and she's from New Zealand. She's a poet and an artist. This morning I learned the English word gauze, finely woven medical cloth, comes from the Arabic word gaz or gaza, because Gazans have been skilled weavers for centuries. I wondered then, how many of our wounds have been dressed because of them, and how many of theirs have been left open because of us.
Thank you, Trish. If we could turn to the back of our books, and there we have basically what is the philosophy of this church. Love is the doctrine of this church, the quest of truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer, to dwell together in peace and in freedom, to serve mankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony with the divine. This do we covenant with each other and with God. Our second hymn is number 76, and it's For Flowers That Bloom About Our Feet.
Thank you.
The story I'm going to tell you is about Beculia and Petrov. And Beculia and Petrov lived in Moldova. Now, Moldova is very near Russia. You've heard of Russia. And they lived on a mountain called Golden Mountain. And the thing about this mountain, I suppose it was about the size of Bray Head, if you can imagine Bray Head. And they lived on the size. And the thing about this mountain was it was made of gold. And you would imagine that the people living on a golden mountain would be very, very happy. But they weren't. Well, at least the women weren't. Because the mountain was horrible. It had caves in it which leaked. It had sneaky snakes, and it had bears going all over the mountain, and people were woken up at night and frightened. And the women were really getting very, very fed up with this. Beculia was the princess. Petrov was the chief. And of course, Beculia said to Petrov one day, "We have to get out of this mountain. We have to get off this mountain because we're all miserable." And Petrov said, "No, we can't go because it's made of gold and somebody will steal the gold." And the children have great fun here. They throw gold pebbles at each other. And if we go, the gold will be stolen. Now, I didn't tell you, which I'm going to tell you now, is that the reason that they couldn't sell the gold was because all the people who lived around, all the tribes, were afraid of them. And they were afraid of them because the men painted their teeth green and their ears red, and the women shaved their heads. They wore skorts. I don't know if you've heard of skorts. They're sort of shorts, and I don't quite know. And they wore those, and that was just the men. And this frightened everybody around, so they wouldn't go near them. So eventually, Beculia got all the girls together one night, and it was a Tuesday, and they were doing their Kegel floor exercises, as they did every Tuesday. And they were sitting around anyway, and Beculia said, "We have to do something about this." And the girls agreed, and they went to Petrov. He was the chief. Okay? And they said to Petrov, "We have to go." And Petrov says, "We can't go. We can't leave all that gold." Well, she said, "You better do it." And the men noticed something very peculiar happening. They noticed that their dinners began to become cold. They noticed that the women disappeared from their caves at night. And they noticed that the women wouldn't talk to them. Beculia stopped talking to Petrov. So eventually Petrov gave in and said, "Okay, we'll go, we'll go, we'll go." And Beculia said, "You know, it's Fader Lynn, we can do it." And the reason they spoke very good Irish down there, and the reason was because a Catholic priest had come down to turn them into Catholics. But he fell in love with one of the women, and that was the end of his mission. So, anyway, that's just an aside. I thought you might like to know. Anyway, they decided they would leave. And basically, Beculia took over. And she said that they were to get a whole load of bags, and they were to fill the bags with all the gold pebbles. And they were going the next day. They were going to leave Golden Mountain forever. So the next day, 600 people started to leave Golden Mountain. And Petrov was still grumpy. And Petrov said, look, he said, where are we going? And she said, "No, the women have decided. What we'll do is we'll walk for 10 days and we'll go 5 days straight, and then on the sixth day, we'll turn left, and then we'll go back. And our new homeland will be in that area." So off they set, and they walked and walked, and they turned left, and they turned around, and they arrived at their final destination. And Petrov said, "But how do we know what the border of our new homeland is?"
Peculiar told him something he didn't know. She said, "What we've done is, we have put holes in all those bags of gold. And the holes, the gold, little gold pebbles, dropped out of the bags as we walked. And over the next few weeks, we'll tell the children to go back that route, take their time, and to put sticks down and to take the gold back to us." And they lived quite happily there for some time. But Peculia, being the kind and decent woman she was, she said, "We're going to name our new homeland Petrovia, in honor of her husband, who was, as you can gather, was a bit of a usilosity." So that's the story. Now, can you think of any moral that you might come from that story? Would you learn anything from it? Well, what about now? Yes, please.
There's no real mountains that can be made of gold.
Well, yes, okay. I don't know if that's true, but maybe, yes, probably true. Yes, good boy.
Times can change.
Times can change. Very excellent. Very, very good. And the other thing you could learn is that when you have enough gold, you have enough gold. You don't need to keep waiting for the gold and not moving. And what also Peculia did, which was very good, they gave up the skorts, they grew their hair, and the men stopped painting their teeth and their ears because they had to compromise to make the people around them like them. So the two messages, we all have enough gold, we really don't need very much more. And the second one is that sometimes we have to compromise. So thank you very much for coming up. You've been very brave.
Our second reading is on the theme of our address later on, is The Planter's Daughter by Austin Clarke. Now, I think this is one of the most beautiful poems ever written because it tells us something very interesting about how different people can live in the same space and be not of the same community, even though they're under the same sky. And perhaps the challenge for all of us is to ensure that everybody under the same sky can be a member of the one community. When night stirred at sea and the fire brought a crowd in, they say that her beauty was music in mouth, and few in the candlelight thought her too proud, for the house of the planter is known by the trees. Men that had seen her drank deep and were silent. The women were speaking wherever she went, as a bell that is rung or a wonder told shyly. And oh, she was the Sunday in every week. We now have a short reflection, and it will conclude with a musical interlude by Doreen, Element. Let us be grateful for our time together, for this religious community with all its virtues and hopes. In this short reflection, let us think of the ways in which we might have failed as a community, and how these failings could be addressed. But most of all, let us appreciate that we have the space for this reflection without the demands of creedal or other tests. Jennifer Flegg perhaps expressed it best in her book Room for the Goats, when she said in a sermon that when she walked into this church for the first time in 1989, she knew within minutes that she had found the place where she belonged. "It is a church," she said, "which had room for the goats as well as the sheep." "Here is a whole community like me," she wrote, "who were bonded not just by a code of belief, but by a desire to follow their own spiritual path, and at the same time to give space and respect to the paths other people were following." For myself, it was not quite the same experience. It took a little while to adjust to "O God, our help in ages past, and onward Christian soldiers," indeed to what at first seemed like a Protestant tone, which is perhaps still reflected in the half cups of free trade coffee offered after our services. But within a short time, like many of us, I knew this was my spiritual community, my tribe. And community, particularly a religious community, is the theme of this address. Community has been highlighted recently in the response of this congregation to great distress which has fallen on some of our fellow members. And we see it every Sunday, and on other days in the voluntary contributions so many make to the church and in the many social activities. One member of this church, when at a low ebb, has a routine of imagining walking up the steps before service and greeting and being greeted by as many members of the congregation as can be remembered. It's an exercise which brings solace, and it highlights one of the many ways, however small, in which this congregation, this community, brings value to each of us. One definition of community says it is a body of people having common organization or interests, or who live in the same place under the same laws. Another description is, a community is a social unit with shared, socially significant characteristics such as place, set of norms, culture, religion, values, customs, or identity. Academics, of course, have delved into the meaning of community. Let's take one of them, Max Scheler, a German philosopher, who refines this definition even more. He outlines the ways in which a community is both like and unlike a family or corporation. And perhaps he could be describing Unitarianism when he sees the community as a sort of supra-individual with a mind and will of its own, which is in some sense distinct from the minds and wills of its individual members. Perhaps another way of putting it, it is that we live in each other's shadows. Erskoa Kela Avaron Nadina, as the Irish saying has it. Kate Chadbourne on YouTube tells it well. We live in each other's shadow, in the shelter of one another, and not just in the sense that everything we do affects each other. We need each other, and we could add that we need community. Canon Hayes recognized this in 1937, when in Tipperary town he launched Muintir na Tíre with the core principles of neighborliness, self-help, and self-reliance, the emphasis being on local improvement, social, economic, cultural, and recreational. Today, Muintir supports 1,000 community groups nationally. A similar emphasis, although perhaps more economic, emerged with Father Mike Dyer in Donegal's Glencullum Kill. We could mention, too, the successful men's sheds, which have brought a sense of community, albeit a purely male one, to many isolated men. And we remember in recent years Robert Putnam, in his book Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of the American Community, which Jennifer referred to in her service. You may remember Bertie Ahern brought him over to Ireland 20 years ago to speak to Fianna Fáil. Putnam had noted the decline of social capital in the United States, how there were no third spaces where people could meet cheaply. There was a dearth of civic space. Due to car-oriented design and increased commercialization, it was harder just to hang out, unlike, say, in a Mediterranean village where people, barely consuming anything, would meet for a chat. People were choosing to engage in activities individually rather than communally, which was putting at risk, it was said, the United States' capacity to build social capital. In fact, The Guardian last week had a story about a group called More in Common, who say exactly the same thing is happening in Britain, where, because of COVID and social media and various other things, people are now bowling alone rather than together. And Putnam distinguishes between bonding capital and bridging capital. The first occurs among similar people, same race, religion, etc. And the second involves having the same activities among dissimilar people. Peaceful multi-ethnic societies require both, he says. And he could have said, so do healthy religious groups. Indeed, you could say that our relationship with Northern Ireland non-subscribing Presbyterians is a combination of bridging and bonding capital. And while some philosophers, of course, stress the importance of community, others emphasize that of the autonomous individual. But I'd like to think we have the balance right between both. Ultimate independence for the individual, but under the umbrella of our congregation, which motivates its members to be spiritual explorers, a description used by Aidan when referring to Teilhard de Chardin on May the 11th, rather, he said, than spiritual believers. We are defined, we could say, by our desire to explore, and ideally in this exploration, we accept that there may be disagreements about services, about hymns, governance, and personalities, both within our congregation and in the wider denomination. Such is the dynamism of a human spiritual organization. A look at two respected religious communities indicates the fissures within any community, whether secular or religious, are quite common. Community does not necessarily imply unanimity on everything. Quakers, the Society of Friends, from their heroic caring of the starving during the Great Famine to the 1798 rebellion when they fed and nursed the wounded, had many controversies and disputes. So Maurice Wingham tells us in his book, The Irish Quakers. In the 1800s, a breakaway group, the White Quakers, were formed. Members were disowned. There were criticisms of luxury, extravagance, and self-seeking, as the Quakers, you see, had become prosperous through hard work and their reputation for honesty. And at one time, something I didn't know, there were four White Quaker meeting houses in Clonmel, Waterford, Mount Mellick, and Dublin. They were, as Maurice Wingham writes, extremely Puritan, abhorring all forms of decoration, using only scrubbed or white painted furniture. Mirrors and watches were banned, and in their desire for truth, They even removed their clothing and went barefoot. The most extreme case was two girls who removed their clothes and walked through Longford town dressed only in chestnut leaves. We're told that the white Quakers settled down at an estate at Newlands in Clondalkin, where they supported themselves by gardening and, it is reported, growing grapes. I wonder, is the garden centre there a descendant of the white Quakers? But the whole movement only lasted 15 years. Dubliners may remember too how the charitable intent of the Quakers led to Victor Bewley and his brothers transferring the capital of the cafes to a community trust, the Bewley Community Limited, for the benefit of all working in the company. Of course, a more abiding memory might be the almond buns, coffee proffered, already milked, and the swirling tobacco smoke over the cake stands as the waitress asked you, "What did you have?" and the tables reserved only for staff. While members of the community could not gain personally from the shares, any income was used to promote the relief and employment of deprived people. The firm was sold in 1986. And we could look at the Methodists. Dudley Leveston Cooney, in his book The Methodists in Ireland, says it has been the practice for Methodists to go to the Church of Ireland to receive the sacraments. But an increasing number of them had no connection with the Church of Ireland, and so a demand rose for communion to be administered at Methodist meetings, leading to a rift for over 60 years from 1816, when what were called the primitive Wesleyans separated from the main body of Methodists. It would be a shame not to mention as well some of John Wesley's advice to preachers. "Be steadily serious," he said. "There is no country on earth where this is more necessary than Ireland. As you are generally encompassed with those who, with little encouragement, would laugh or trifle from morning to night." On this and every other occasion, Wesley said, "Avoid all familiarity with women. You cannot be too wary in this respect." And on hymns, and this is for the choir, he said, "Sing lustily and with good courage. Sing modestly, do not bawl." And of course, just like the Quakers and the Methodists, religions, as Bill Darlison has told us in his book, The Penultimate Truth, grow within a culture and help nurture a culture. Mancon McGann, in his fascinating book, 32 Words for Field, details an Irish culture which is all but gone. Rather than asking, "Not to, is it yourself?" people would ask, "Cé d'or thiabhtú?" Who are you of? In other words, from what community do you come out of? When the population of the Great Blaskets was forcibly moved to the mainland, life was a continual series of visits to other people's homes. There was even a special word for such visiting, scoriocht, and another word, botontiocht, which means visiting neighbours to hear old stories. And it was a world where many people believed in leprechauns and fairies. In 1937, over 100,000 children were asked to query their grandparents in regard to the little people. There are 375 accounts of encounters with leprechauns, 39 of them in Cork. Mancon himself was given what he was assured was a real leprechaun pipe, although I think he was sceptical when he saw Irish Trades Association stamped on the back of it. So it is perhaps no wonder that within that community and culture, there might have been a receptivity to certain aspects of Catholicism. Religions, as Bill Darlison said, grow with a culture which, Mancon McGann reminds us, had a widespread system of mehel or girth, where neighbours shared resources, cooperators in ploughing and hay harvesting, and lit fires on hilltops to ensure the help of Lug, the Celtic god, for a successful harvest. A look at monasticism is perhaps for another time. Emma Donoghue's book Haven gives a flavour of it in the 7th century. And the sharing of a communal lifestyle was adopted by some Christians in the early church. And then there were other more modern attempts to create Christian communities, such as the Society of Brothers, Bruderhof, Shakers, who didn't engage in sexual reproduction, and the Amana community, another one, the Farm, the Findhorn, which, like us, had no creed, and the Church of Armageddon. According to John Saliba, many such movements, which usually dwindled, had a strong leader, a rigorous system of social control and behavior, and were economically sufficient with members separated from the outside world. They have what Robert Putman referred to as bonding, not bridging social capital. So, to conclude, we can see that communities, whether religious or not, strive and are thrive in their surrounding cultural settings, whether it's John Wesley and his preachers struggling with their lack of Irish, Catholicism trying to regulate believers in fairies and fairy forts, or dissension among Quakers because of their increasing prosperity. And we've seen during the papal consistory how Catholics can be divided over doctrine and sex gender issues, a prime example being the spat between the official church and Catholic convert J.D. Vance, the U.S. vice president, over Ordo Amoris, the order in which one is obliged to dispense love and charity. For Vance, you love your family first, then your neighbor, then your community, then your fellow citizens in your own country. Then after that, according to Vance, you can focus on the rest of the world. Pope Francis, however, in a letter to US bishops, rejected any attempt to use Catholic theology to justify an immigration crackdown. People, he said, should meditate on the Good Samaritan. That is, by meditating on the love that builds a fraternity open to all without exception. And as Gavin reminded us 3 weeks ago, the future Leo XIV has also disagreed with Vance's view that love should be prioritized within one's community before extending it to others. Vance, he said, was just wrong. What Francis and Leo were emphasizing, perhaps, is that while we may live in different types of community, we are all part of one big community, humanity, a humanity which has its strengths and weaknesses, just like the various communities mentioned earlier, that we all live in each other's shadow, that we need each other, and that like Austin Clark's The Planter's Daughter, we share the same sky as those who live outside the house that is known by the trees. If we want to reflect on the health of this Unitarian community, a prayer from a Bradford, England service might be helpful. If you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together. We have, I think, somewhat managed to do that, to go together. And we're all very reassured by a comment from another congregation member. When I am in this church, I feel I am the best version of myself. Thank you. Our third hymn is Now is the time approaching. It's 1:44, after which may we have the collection. Our notices. Thank you, everyone who contributed to this service, to Ayla for all the work she does to make the church habitable for us when we come in, to Trish for her lovely reading, Teresa for the flowers, Robin and Margaret, our welcomers, Gráinne, Alison and John, our coffee team, and of course, vital for our survival, our collectors, Janet, Madeline, Paula, and Trish. The open pulpit remains open, and the next slot for anybody, there'll be plenty of time to prepare, is September the 28th. Sunday, a new initiative, Classical Music and Musicians Network are having a concert here on the 29th of June at 2 p.m. The concert is free, although you can give a donation, and this is run by Shari. Pam's weekly service of reflection on Wednesdays continues from 1:05 to 1:35 about. It's also on webcam. The book club is reading Elizabeth Strout's book, Tell Me Everything, and it will meet on the 25th of June at 7:30 in the vestry. Unitarian Walkers, the 12th of July, Frank Tracy is leading a stroll around the Liberties, and this starts at the Four Courts Lewis bus stop. And the Management Committee meets on Monday at 7 o'clock in the vestry. Our final hymn, God of Grace and God of Glory, number 115. We come to this sacred space with thanksgiving for our community, with hope that it may prosper and that it will withstand any future difficulties with grace, resilience, and indeed humour. And remembering that if we want to go far, we must go together. And until we meet again, may the road rise before you. May the wind be always at your back. May the sun shine upon your fields. And may God hold you in this community and yours forever.
and those outside the community in the palm of his hand. Amen.